We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Archaeology Podcast, episode 84, with Chris Webster and Richie Cruz, and this is the recording from the live show, You Call This Archaeology, from January 26th, 2019. Let's dig a little deeper. Welcome to You Call This Archaeology, episode 73. Oof. And now that we've got this kind of figured out a little bit, if you want the better audio version of this, and you want it, you know, on your own time, like maybe you don't have time to listen to the whole thing today, then go check out archpodnet.com/archaeology, and it'll be episode 84 over there, and it's going to come out on Saturday, a week from yesterday.
Oh, there's one thing I'm curious about. How much of this are you going to edit out?
Well, I edit out certainly all the beginning, so yeah. Yep, thanks, Michael. Sounds like something is not plugged all the way in. Check your ins and outs. I hear you, man. We're using some different equipment, so and it wasn't tested prior to this, room.
He says much better now.
Yeah, he says much better. So it's still not up to the quality that we really like to have, but it is better. So,
oh, man. See, this is why I need to get back in the field so I can get more money.
It's not more money. We had a setup that was working. I don't know what stopped. Like, why this computer won't read this board. That's really the problem.
Which is really strange.
Yeah. It's just a problem that we can't try to fix live. We have to try to fix when we're not live.
Interesting. So. I can always call you next week. Like, you're going to be here, like, around.
Well, let's talk about this off air.
Oh, yeah.
So. All right. So, we do have some stuff that I wanted to bring up this week.
Ooh.
I don't know. Richie, do you have topics in mind, or do you want me to go ahead and kick this off?
Well, I had two things to think about.
But go ahead.
One of the things
Of them related to archaeology?
No.
Figures. How about Virginia Street?
No? Oh, it's close. Well, I mean, sort of.
Of course it is.
It is interesting because I was going to shoot a video about, I already mentioned this last week, didn't I? About changing a tire.
Mm-hmm.
I forget if I mentioned it on air.
Yeah.
But the thing is, I have now changed my route so I don't drive down Virginia, so I don't get a, because it's the twice now that I got a big nail.
Yeah.
One on my bike and one on my damn truck, which is not supposed to happen since it's the Kevlar tires.
Yeah.
Which is crazy to me.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. You know.
I mean, the other thing I really want to talk about, even though I realize it's not about archaeology at all, is that Kobe Bryant died today.
That's crazy.
Yeah. But more importantly, you know, obviously there are all the news stories and condolences and stuff like that. And more importantly, what happened. And then I get to Fox News and it's just like, President Trump says this.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm like, are you joking?
Yeah. That's what they were concerned with.
Of course.
Yep. The unfortunate thing is, I mean, he's a well-known personality. So
true. Oh, by the way, this mixer does not do EQ.
Yeah. It's really not, I mean, it's really is just in its basic sense, just a mixer.
Yeah.
Like it takes two signals and mixes them into one. That's really all it does, which I'm not sure why we even need that because we have one signal going into it. So why is it even in the circuit chain here?
Oh.
In the signal chain.
Because I can't bring my mic, you know, without testing it a lot more.
Okay.
Yeah, directly. I mean, theoretically I could eventually.
Sure.
Yeah.
It just doesn't seem like we're not mixing anything and it's not EQing, so
true.
I'm not really sure what its purpose is.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, when I was gonna use it, like I can plug it in my DSLR and then I can have two lab mics.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's not what we're doing here though.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. I'm wondering what its purpose is in this signal chain.
Oh, because it's a USB.
Okay. Sounds good. Yeah, but your mic is plugged in with a jack that would probably work in your computer.
I know.
So I know. Anyway. So that's a topic for another type of show.
Wow, I'm still amazed we still have six viewers after all that ping-ponging.
Yeah. Thanks for sticking with us. Hey, viewers, if you're viewing us, first give us a comment. We've got Michael commenting in here. I know there's other people in, so throw in a comment. Do you have questions? Have you seen anything in the news? I want to talk about something if we saw the news.
Well, go ahead.
And the way it goes. Yeah, so I'll link to this in the show notes over at archpodnet.com/84. Archpodnet.com/archaeology/84. And the title of the article, it's from Archaeology World, and it's called A Student Found an Ancient Canadian Village That's 10,000 Years Older Than the Pyramids. Okay. I have two issues with that. The first one is students find lots of stuff because field schools are typically where a lot of academic archaeology is found.
Yeah.
And I mean, all but one of the people on that crew is a student, right? In some way or another.
True.
Whether you're talking about grad students that are being paid to be there or students that paid to be there, it doesn't matter. Typically, they're mostly all students. So calling this person out as a student just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And I think it's a little bit degrading to the person. I mean, they're still an archaeologist. And, it's just, I don't know, it's poor writing. The other one is the pyramids. Now, the initial mention in the article title here, I think should have been maybe in the body of the article, but the title is a little much. But then they say 10,000 years older than the pyramids. It should be the founding or making or construction of the pyramids, first off, but because the pyramids still exist.
True.
But anyway, the article goes on to say some really cool stuff about this Canadian site in, it says 300 miles north of Victoria in British Columbia, which does make sense for a 14,000-year-old site because we're talking about either coastal migration or land bridge migration.
Yeah.
And so that fits for the time period because we have 14,000-year-old sites in Oregon and, all the way up and some older stuff up in Alaska, too.
Yeah.
But they make another comparison in this article to Egypt, and they say, they mention the pyramids again, first off, and then they say to understand how old that truly is, one has to consider that the ancient ruler of Egypt, Cleopatra, first off, not the only ancient ruler of Egypt, lived closer in time to you than she did to the creation of the pyramids. Who cares? And not even say when she ruled. Clearly it was sometime, I don't even remember, but it was sometime
we can look it up.
Pre-zero. So it would have been, my guess is she ruled sometime around 500 to 1000 BC, but I honestly don't remember. So it had to have been around that time period though.
Oh, there we go. See, she died around 30 BC.
30. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's just a weird comparison because they give nothing, they give no dates, they give no, comparison to it. And here too, the student who helped discover the site is a PhD student. So she's a graduate student.
And more importantly, she'd already be earning money and teaching classes.
Yeah. If she's a graduate student, like a PhD student, she's already an archaeologist.
Yeah.
She probably has an undergrad in archaeology or anthropology.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know, but that makes her an archaeologist. So they could have just said archaeologists discover and not call her out as a student. Who cares that she's a student?
More importantly, she might have gone back after 10 years and in the field.
Yeah. And exactly. And says she and her team began investigating the area. So just as we start whittling this down a little bit here, it sounds like she's probably running a field school or running a project.
Yeah.
And this is part of her dissertation research probably. And it belittles her as an archaeologist and as a professional, even if she's a PhD candidate. And it also, I wonder if this has something to do with her being a woman, to be honest. I mean, I hate to say that, but if it was a guy PhD student, they would have said archaeologist, but because it's a woman, it's a student.
More importantly, it's also a bad photo of her. If you go to the article, it's going to be a bad photo. I mean, I can't even tell if that's her, if it's just someone randomly on the site.
There's no way to know. So, and I don't like it when articles aren't the people who write the article don't own it, this just says it was written by the Archaeology World team. I guarantee you one person wrote this. I mean, maybe it was edited by a few different people, but
it was probably not someone very senior, or alternatively, it might be someone who just doesn't want their name in there.
Who knows? Who knows? But the archaeology writing in here is just atrocious.
Oh my God. This makes me think of, we were talking about it before the show, but that outdoor article where that person was basically looting arrowheads and outside was celebrating it. But that's not the important part. The important part is that if you go through the outside, the comments on the outside article, it's the most interesting thing.
Yeah.
It really is a microcosm of what people think about archaeology.
So let's preface this by giving the context of the article before we start talking about it.
Yeah, it's an outside, for those of you who haven't been to a newsstand in a while, and I think that's everyone, is a magazine that's dedicated to like the outdoor lifestyle. So it like does reviews on tents, and it goes talks about cool places you can go and like what to do there, and like talks about hikes and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And this article was about a person who like collects arrowheads.
Yeah.
You know, and it was like, you know, highlighting her and her, you know, what she does. And obviously that is, you know, it like it's interesting because it highlights the fact that a lot of people, they don't understand that the sight is the important thing and not the and not the little tchotchkes you take away.
right.
I mean, I had a good metaphor for it earlier in the week, but you know, whatever. But the thing that interested me was the comments. Because obviously they're the usual comments about disapproving archaeologists and then like, you know, people calling archaeologists elitist and whatnot.
Sure.
But the one comment that really stood out to me was this one person that said, look, I don't see any archaeology in these subdivisions that you guys are like going through and like surveying. Yeah. Why don't you go overseas and just do all that archaeology stuff? Because that's where all the real archaeology is. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people literally, you know, a lot of people literally just don't think of Native American stuff. Like, you know, I mean, I guess that's an oxymoron, but, you know, they don't think of Native American stuff as anything interesting.
Yeah.
You know, because I was talking to a neighbor last week, and then a friend of his comes out and he, you know, is retired.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently he must have worked in some sort of construction or mining industry because my neighbor told him, hey, he's an archaeologist. And he goes, ugh. You're the liberal. Oh, God. You're one of the liberals who tells us that there's Native American stuff here, you know, and I'm like, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, wow. It's just like such a continuing disrespect of Native American stuff and like their culture and their, you know, their artifacts that they left behind.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things I find about like that article from Outdoor Magazine.
Yeah.
And I will try to link to this if I can pull that up again for the arcpodnet.com/archaeology/84 episode in the show notes. But it's interesting because it does highlight, you know, somebody finding stuff on say private land, right? And people that like to go find artifacts and do stuff, you know, plowed fields are a great way to do that back in the Midwest and the West Coast or the East Coast, because there's a lot of stuff that's just under the surface. And every time the plow goes over, it just churns up a bunch of stuff. Right. So you see them out there, and people who own the land, they typically don't really care that much and they'll let people go out there, or they'll go out there illegally sometimes and find things. But the thing I don't like is first off, you have your collectors that are trying to sell stuff, you know, and that just puts a value on it.
Yeah.
A monetary value. And then also you have a lot of people call themselves artifact hunters. And I'm like, hunting? Yeah. Is hunting really the right word for this? Yeah. You know, is this something that can either A, fight back, or that you have to use a weapon for?
Yeah.
And why are you calling it hunting? Yeah. You know, hunting for artifacts. I mean, I guess we go on Easter egg hunts. Maybe that's where it comes from.
Oh my God. I remember the simile I had earlier in the week because I was thinking about it.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, a lot of these people, they get their little tchotchke, their little arrowhead or whatever, and they say, oh my God, this makes me feel so much closer to history.
Yeah.
And then I was watching a video about, was that Shanghai Disneyland or maybe Hong Kong Disneyland?
Yeah.
And the controversy over like shark fin soup and stuff like that. You know, and I was thinking, you know, a lot of people kill rhinos for their horn. A lot of people like kill sharks for like their fins.
Yeah.
But they don't bullshit you by saying, oh, it's because I want to like honor the, like, I want to be closer to the majesty of the shark. They're at least, you know, honest with themselves about what they really want.
Right.
They really just want that one thing, and they don't care if they have to kill like the animal to get it. It's the same thing with a site. People don't really care about history anymore. You know, a lot of these looters don't care about history. They just want their little like souvenir.
Yeah.
And they don't care if they have to destroy the site to get it.
Yeah. I know. Yeah. People just look at the stuff. And, you know, looking back at this link that's on Facebook.
Yeah.
So what I'll have to link to is actually a Facebook link, because this is the Outdoor Channel's Facebook page that posted this. I don't think I realized that at first.
Yeah, that's the one where
it's
I'll
not
be.
An article.
No, it's. Oh, wait. I forgot about that, too. But it's the. Yeah. That's where I got the comments from. Oh, by the way, if you look really closely at the photo, you see that she's actually in a field.
She's in a plowed field.
Yeah.
For sure. She has a. What I would think is a shovel, but it's got a flat end on it. I'm not really sure. It's almost like a homemade shovel. I'm not sure what that is.
Oh wait, you mean like the type used to scrape a wall?
I don't know. I mean, I can only see the handle, but it doesn't look like a normal shovel you would buy at a hardware store.
Interesting.
And the comment here, it's from Tekka_Doyle_outdoors on Instagram.
Oh, you're going to look her up now?
Yeah, I might just do that. So let's find out who she is.
Oh, interesting. Oh, hey, look. Corey Bruce says he cares about history.
He does.
Yeah. Oh,
Corey
interesting.
Corey shares an office with me.
Oh, he does?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh.
How's it going, Corey?
Interesting. Where is he? Is he on vacation?
No, he's at home probably.
Oh.
So, although I think he's supposed to be flying somewhere today. So maybe he's on an airplane. Who knows? But anyway, and Carlton Gover joined, of the, one of the hosts of the Life in Ruins podcast. Go check that out.
Is he the person I keep hearing on the ads?
David did one of the ads. I think we're playing David's ad right now. So, but John. Carl's the one you hear on the ads that has the Darth Vader sounds in the background because he's always toking on his jewel. Anyway, hey, Tekka, Tekka Doyle _outdoors has 4,089 followers on Instagram, only 221 posts, and says she calls herself a Michigan sportswoman, hunting, fishing, artifact hunter. Apparently, she has a YouTube channel called Tekka and Mike's Artifact Addiction.
Oh.
We need to check that out. And all her pictures here are her holding either projectile points or dead animals. Wow, she is something else.
Gross. Oh, by the way, John Flood says, he's got a very long comment, but I'll boil it down. Mississippians constructed earthen pyramids throughout the eastern woodlands, but yet it's not archaeology, quote unquote.
Exactly. Why don't we reference the fantastic mound structures within the eastern, like he said, the eastern woodlands, the Ohio Valley. Serpent Mound, Cahokia, for Christ's sake. Yeah. I mean, we got so many things we could talk about in reference to the older article that we were talking about, the 14,000-year-old thing. So,
well, the thing is also, like, how many people would destroy, like, you know, would destroy a pyramid like that to get, like, the treasures they think they're inside.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Corey said he's at home preparing his flight to Atlanta.
So wow, this is so handy.
He's going tonight.
This is so cool that we can both, like, look at the chat now.
I know, right? So.
Oh, my God.
Anyway, let's take a quick break for the Archaeology Show listeners.
Yeah.
And for members of the Archaeology Podcast Network, you're not going to hear a commercial because you're listening to this in your early downloads area.
True.
For more information, archpodnet.com/members. For everybody else, we're going to come right back on the live stream here. But we're going to take a quick editing break just for the Archaeology Show podcast listeners, and we'll be right back. Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high-quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high-quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months or go to Zencastr.com and use the code TAS. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode. Welcome back to episode 84 of the Archaeology Show on the Archaeology Podcast Network, but also episode 73 of You Call This Archaeology on YouTube and Twitch and Happy Archaeology Fun Time and right here on Facebook.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, my God. You know.
Yeah.
I mean, I was asking you about the Marques Brownlee podcast before the show, but that's because the episode he just released was about all the stuff he goes through to, like, produce his video.
Yeah.
And then today I was watching a YouTube video where someone was talking about how they spend basically 10 hours a day, 7 days a week on their YouTube channel.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, he was like making fun of the fact that people go up to him and like, are made like, you know, what, you spend more than an hour on this? Because, you know, his videos are usually about 10 minutes long. So they assume it takes like an hour from the beginning.
Yeah, but they're really well produced.
Yeah. And the thing is, you know, you see it all the time in his videos that he has like a person there, like he has staff, mm-hmm. basically. And then one of the things I didn't realize is that Marques Brownlee, he has like a big staff, like four people and like a big office and stuff like that.
He didn't start out that way, though.
That's
true. Started out in his college dorm room.
That's true. But, you know, to make the videos he does now.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking, you know, Jordan Harbinger, when they, at the end of the show, you know, that's a good show, by the way, you should listen to that.
Yeah.
But, you know, he always, like, gives credit to, like, his staff there, too. Mm-hmm. And I realized, wow, like, it's just you. Like, I realized you put in a lot of work for, like, the amount of content that comes out. It's just you.
Well, for the Archaeology Podcast Network, yes, the editing is just me.
Yeah.
But we do have... we have currently, including Tristan, who's the co-founder of the APN, him, and then 1, 2, 3, 4, at least 5 or 6 others that are helping with social media and marketing in the back end. And they're all volunteers, except for one, Madison,
True.
Who is our new advertising manager, because advertising is the thing that's going to pay for everything.
Yeah, but that's like a relatively recent development.
That's in the last month. Yeah, before that, we were just haphazardly doing advertising. And you're right, I do a lot of work, and it is from an hour standpoint, I probably just do the most if you were going to quantify it, because editing is so time-consuming.
Yeah.
And yeah, it would be nice, but the problem with audio editing as opposed to, say, video editing is you can, in video editing, you can take and break those activities up. Like
That's
somebody's
true.
Obviously, Marques is recording it.
Yeah.
He's the person on camera. He's probably involved with maybe script development or how they're going to shoot the show, something like that. But then somebody else is possibly running the camera. I mean, I'm just guessing here, but with video, you got somebody doing that. But even in the production of the video, you might have one person who does a rough cut and then another person that goes in and puts in the graphics and lower thirds and stuff like that. And then somebody else that maybe even does the final mastering of the whole thing and then does all the posting to YouTube and stuff.
But the reason I want to bring that up is because I feel like a lot of people at home who are A, watching this, and B, might be listening to this, don't realize that this actually takes a lot of work to get done.
Yeah.
You know, I was also thinking about that last night because I was listening to his podcast while I was editing another video. It's like, wow, this is taking forever.
I know.
And I was, technically, I guess I shouldn't say last night since I didn't get to sleep till 5. Like, literally, it's just like, oh, my God. I can, a few more minutes just, like, cutting here and cutting there and blah, blah, blah.
So you woke up right before you came in here at 3:30?
No, actually, I'm averaging, like, 5 hours of sleep or so, which is crazy because my goal right now is to, like, get as many videos as I can done before I head out in the field. Like, basically have a whole yearly, a slate for the whole year.
There you go. There you go. Hey, real quick, if anybody listening to this is, you know, enjoying what they're hearing and entertained, hit the share button.
That too.
Share it to a group you belong to that allows that, or share it to your own page.
Yeah.
And those people can join in and you know, learn something maybe.
More importantly, it's always fun to respond to the comments.
Yes. So something I want to talk about now, just to switch gears a little bit, is boats.
Oh.
I'm always talking about boats now. Yeah.
Oh, wait, is that close to the happening?
Well, I mean, what do you mean? Oh, living?
Yes.
No. We're no closer to that at all. But what I do want to talk about is one of the reasons that I pulled the trigger on buying a boat last summer.
Yeah.
And I've got, for anybody who's interested in geeking out on this thing, I've got a 22-foot Mirage 217. It's a 1989, basically, you know, single-hull speedboat.
Yeah.
And it's heavy, weighs about 5,000 pounds, about closer to 6, loaded up with fuel and stuff, you know, our gear and things.
Yeah.
It's got a small cuddy cabin with basically a V-berth kind of thing, but it's got like a queen size on the wide end and then, you know, pinches down to your feet. Lots of lights on the inside and then what's called a bimini top, which is basically the top that just kind of folds up on a boat, but then a wraparound canvas to make it an enclosed like tent area in the back. And it's great. It's got a Chevy, what's the equivalent of like, it's a Mercruiser 7.1 liter, I think 7.1 or 7.4 liter engine. But it's equivalent of about a Chevy 454. Big block with 330 horsepower engine. So burns a ton of fuel. So geek out on that. But...
Yeah.
The reason, I love boats, right? I've never I haven't owned one as an adult. We had them when I was a kid growing up all the time, right? We always owned boats. Never really good boats. I mean, we weren't rich and had a ton of money. Yeah. My dad would find something for like a couple grand with an engine on it, and we'd hope to get, you know, a season out of it, water skiing and stuff.
Oh my God. I was just thinking about that boat we found in Arizona last year in the mountains.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's not the kind of boat I'm talking about. Anyway, so this thing was a good deal because we could, it was a good price and it's very not fuel efficient, but we were able to like camp on it. And we're just, in fact, I was just talking to Corey today about, you know, going up boating into Lake Tahoe this summer. And, you know, we love spending the weekend on it, take it up on a Friday, leave on a Sunday, and just spend the whole weekend out there. And it's just amazing. But anyway, one of the reasons why I mentally decided to pull the trigger on it and why it became a business expense for me, which is if you own a business, try to expense everything you can, but you can't do it illegally. You have to have legitimate business uses for it, right?
That's
so one
true.
Of the things a boat can be used for is, first off, taking clients out. That's a no-brainer. You know, if I have clients, whether it's through DoneSafe, which I work through Corion, or whether it's through my archaeology business or podcast clients, I mean, it's like owning a vehicle or owning owning a you know, vacation home. A lot of companies own like suites in hotels and things like that where they can just bring clients. Those are all business expenses, right?
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. If you get like that bigger boat like you're planning to, you can always turn like the main salon into like, you know, a recording studio / recording, like, you know, like a background sort of space.
Yeah, that would be good for video. But as far as podcasting goes, I'm definitely looking for a bigger boat with a third stateroom that can be turned into a recording studio.
Yeah.
Because most of the ones I'm looking at have two full staterooms and then sometimes usually a smaller third or a full third, depending on the size of the boat. Yeah. But anyway, point is with this boat, well, I do want to sell it eventually. It's not a forever boat.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a starter boat for me. And, you know, it's a jumping off point to bigger and better things. But one of the things I want to do with it, and I want to see if anybody that's still listening has any comments or ideas on this. But my initial thought was Lake Tahoe has a lot of history to it.
That's true, too.
A lot of history. And we're looking at keeping the boat up at Lake Tahoe this summer. But I would only do that if I can get this project off the ground because, A, it's really expensive to keep the boat in the lake at Lake Tahoe. It's about $1,000 a month.
Wow.
Versus the $200 a month we're paying in Pittsburgh Marina in California, right? So it's about $1,000 a month to keep it in a slip up at Lake Tahoe.
So it has to pay for itself eventually.
Well, it either has to pay for itself or, and I don't even care if it does pay for itself. I want it to be able to justify the expense, though, and put together another podcast. So I was thinking about a new podcast series, two things. One, a new podcast series where it's basically like the history of Lake Tahoe by boat. And because there's a lot of stuff that we would include visuals on the show notes, but it would be basically doing some research and, you know, maybe hitting Lake Tahoe from starting at north, because Tahoe's lakes are round, of course.
Yeah.
And Tahoe's mostly round. It's kind of egg-shaped. But start it maybe north and then do it in 15-degree increments or something like that. What's the history of this 15-degree increment? And talk about that, right?
Yeah.
And then take those podcasts, take that audio, and promote it as something people that do have boats can go out on Lake Tahoe. You can rent boats on Lake Tahoe.
Yeah.
You can go out on a paddleboard, and they can say, well, where am I at on Lake Tahoe? And let me find the degrees that I'm at, and I'll listen to this podcast while I'm out on the lake and learn something about that section of the lake.
It almost makes me wonder if you could pitch it to like the UNR is like a PBS NPR station, right?
I guess, but I want to do this as a podcast.
Yeah.
I don't want to be overproduced in something that, you know, whatever. I want to do it as a podcast. Well, almost a travel podcast, really, but history focused.
Yeah.
And then the other thing would be carrying that in, carrying that on to other places. Like right now we have our boat in the Delta.
Yeah.
What's called the Delta, the Sacramento River Delta or the San Joaquin River Delta. They kind of converge right where our marina is.
Yeah.
And it all leads over to San Francisco Bay. It's first, what's that first bay just north of San Francisco? Is that San Joaquin Bay?
No.
Or something? What is that bay?
Oh, wait. Well,
Susan Bay?
Oh, God. You mean Sassoon Bay?
Sassoon? I don't know how to pronounce it, but.
That's that used to be really famous because that's where the Navy used to have a reserve fleet.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously they were all painted in lead, so that took a while to get cleaned up.
I can imagine, But anyway, I've thought about continuing that on there, except it's way more difficult. Just looking up the history of the Delta, first off, it changes rapidly.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say rapidly, but over the last 100 years, the bars form and landforms change, and people have dug out other pathways, you know, through the Delta because it's basically sand and clay.
Yeah.
And you can just dig it out, and it's super easy. There's not a lot of rock. But there's thousands of miles of channels and river systems and things like that between basically the Pittsburgh area, so north of San Francisco, north of Berkeley. Yeah. And
Corey Bruce
Corey said the mothball fleet in Martinez. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, wait. Maybe I was thinking something else.
Lived in that area. He spent a lot of time in the Delta.
Yeah.
So, but I'd probably have to get like another like local historians or something to go around with me and help create a podcast series for those areas. But you'd have to find a way to let people know how to find it quickly. That's why I love the Lake Tahoe idea, where it's like, if we promote this well enough, they can be like, you know, you include a little map with each podcast and say, oh, so I'm sitting here at 280 to 295 degrees. Let's listen to that episode, you know, and find out all the things about it.
Yeah.
So he said you can take the Delta from Pittsburgh to Sacramento. I know. you can take it to Stockton too. And I've really wanted to do that, but that is a long trip. Yeah. But you can take it all the way by boat, all the way up to Sacramento.
Ooh.
Yeah. We actually thought about putting the boat in the water at Sacramento because it's closer to Reno.
Yeah.
But then you're just kind of limited to linear passages, you know.
That's true.
Yeah.
But then, you know, you'd probably be able to see it more often. More importantly, once the weather gets really nice.
Well, yeah. I mean, once the weather gets better, we're going to definitely bring it back over the hill here.
Which is really crazy because it almost feels like the weather's already nice.
I know. So, but it's still tough to have the boat over here because, A, Tahoe's not nice from a weather standpoint. It's really cold, and we're not going to bring it up there. But also, you know, as long as it still is freezing at night occasionally,
I just
don't want to bother with winterizing the boat, you know, just in case, you know what I mean? I mean, one night of freezing is not going to kill the engine. Even two or three nights of freezing is not going to kill the engine. But you get like a week of deep freezing, and you'll crack your block in a heartbeat. And any other water that happens to have, our boat is super tight. I mean, we never have water in our bilge. And the bilge is, for those that don't know, the lowest point on the boat.
Yeah.
And in our boat, it's right below the engine. That's where our bilge pump is. Because the engine's kind of suspended, and then right below the engine is the bilge, and then there's the plug going out the back, and the bilge pump actually ejects water out of there.
Yeah.
And there's never any water in there, like ever. It's great. We just have a really well-sealed up and tight boat. But the point is, if there is any water, even in any tiny cracks, I mean, you know the freeze-thaw cycle.
That's true.
You know, out in the desert. I mean, any tiny amount of water gets in there, and then it freezes. It just splits a little bit.
Yeah.
Then you can hold more water in there.
That's true.
Then it freezes, splits a little bit. Then you're done.
But interesting. Well, what were you thinking about in terms of like subjects? Were you thinking about like the shipwrecks or the housing or like the basic
stories? I'm thinking about
everything.
And it might take a number of episodes for one set of coordinates, right? For one arc on the compass rose. Because I want to start with, I want to categorize it with, depending on what we have, right?
Yeah.
Like some areas are going to have more information than others. But let's say we have one area with all the information, right? So we have early Paiute that used to live up there. They live up there during the summertime, you know, gather pine nuts and things like that.
Yeah.
And then come back down to the Washoe Valley in the wintertime.
Yeah.
So there's, if we have any prehistoric sites, we'd want to do that research, find out where the prehistoric sites are, see what's been written about up there.
Yeah.
Talk about those, and then talk about the early historic settlement. Mark Twain's been all over the place up there. I mean, he's got his stamp on literally everything up at Lake Tahoe. So talk about him a bit. And then maybe talk about some of the efforts related to mining. Like up in the northeast corner, of the lake, there's the, what is that called? It's called the something ditch, I think, or the whatever. But there's you can hike up to it. It's just near Incline Village.
Oh.
And it's this tunnel basically that they dug through the mountain to get water from Lake Tahoe. They'd pump it up to that point and then you go through the mountain and then it would come out on the other side and go all the way to Virginia City for the mines.
Really?
From Lake Tahoe.
That's kind of crazy.
I know. And that's just really cool information to have.
Yeah.
So
I mean, that's especially crazy since that's a long way.
Yeah. And I think some areas would have less information than others. And maybe if like there's some areas just north of Emerald Bay where it's basically just like sheer cliff faces and like no settlement, you know, who was there? So you could do like a general history of that area. Maybe you could talk about some of the geology, bring that in. Because there's also some interesting things about Lake Tahoe. Like, for example, I saw a geological presentation on Lake Tahoe up here at Coffee Bar a couple of years ago, actually.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah. Oh, did you go to that?
Yeah.
Yeah. I forgot you were at that.
Yeah.
And they were talking about, one of the things that really shocked me is they were talking about how shallow it is up near Kings Beach and over near Tahoe City. And this is on the north end and kind of the northwest end for those that don't know.
Yeah.
And like if you're in a sailboat, we were in a friend's sailboat, and when the lake level was really low like 3 or 4 years ago, like he couldn't put in at Kings Beach anymore because he had a swing keel so he could bring it up.
Yeah.
But then the boat's like really unstable when it's up. So you want to have it down, and it was really difficult to put in up at that lake at that point. But that's just a shelf. And if that shelf ever collapses like the one did, they have evidence of a shelf collapsing on the eastern side of the lake.
Yeah.
And there's also evidence that when that shelf collapsed, it created basically an oscillating tidal wave that there's evidence of up in the hills.
Really?
And if that shelf collapses, I mean, it's going to destroy not only thousands of lives, but it's going to destroy billions of dollars worth of homes. I mean, the nice homes that are on the side of that lake, it's just going to take everything down. So, and it's not going to be pretty. I mean, because the lake is so steep on either side. When a massive wave hits that side, the other side of the lake, it goes up, builds up a whole bunch more kinetic energy, comes right back down into the lake, and it continues on to the other side. And it's just going to go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth until it dies.
Interesting.
And in the process, it's going to destroy everything.
I was going to say, it's like those, like, you know, the kinetic balls.
Yeah, exactly.
Remember that. I don't know if anyone remembers those.
They're called...
They have a name?
Yeah, they're called Einstein... balls or something. Somebody invented them. A famous physicist or something. I thought, what are those called?
Oh.
Anyway, they have a name if you look for them. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So, yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
So that's what I want to do. I think that would be super cool. It would take a ton of research, and I need to build up some other things in my life that will allow me the time to put into that, because podcasting like this is relatively easy. I mean, I've got a few interviews to do this coming week.
Oh.
And it's just...
For the all APN?
For the APN, And all that stuff is basically basically pretty simple. And it's...
anything you can talk about?
I haven't done them yet, so...
Oh, but I meant, you know, any guest you can, like, mention?
Well, let's see. We have one set up for Archaeotech on Tuesday, which will come out in a week and a half. Who are we interviewing? The 28th. We are interviewing Hector A. Orengo. It could be Orengo, but I think it's Orengo. And he is going to be talking about combination of drone-based photogrammetry and artificial intelligence for automated archaeological survey.
Ooh.
I have been talking about this for years.
Oh, my God.
I kind of forgot we were interviewing him because this got scheduled like a month and a half ago.
Cool.
That is going to be super cool. So he has held postdoctoral positions at the CNRS. I don't know what that stands for. We'll find out. In France and at the University of Nottingham, Sheffield, and Cambridge in the UK. Currently a Ramon A. Cajal researcher at the Catalan Institute for Classical Archaeology in Spain, where he co-directs the Landscape Archaeology Research Group, and an honorary research associate at the McDonald Institute for Archaeological Research, University of Cambridge.
Oh my God, that reminds me
super cool interview.
Of one of the coolest things that came out of CES. It's not like available yet, this particular module, because we were talking about it last week. We were talking about like action cameras. And one of the action cameras is it's modular, so you can have the 360 camera, but they've got a special attachment that you can put on a drone and effectively turn your drone into a flying 360 degree camera.
Yeah.
That way you can, like, you know, that way it's not just like a flat photo for, I mean, it's very difficult to describe on a podcast, but basically, you know, you're just not looking at a photo. You can, like, actually, like, look at it. You can look at the landscape from any view you want. Because, you know, we obviously know that sometimes when you walk up to, like, a site, it doesn't look like a site from one angle, but if you walk at it from another angle, it looks like a site.
Yeah.
And so by having a 360 degree, basically by being able to turn your drone to a 360 degree camera, you can like basically look at the landscape in any view you want.
Nice.
Yeah. And, you know,
that's the wave of the future, man.
Yeah. And it's like here. Well, I mean, it's not here right now, but it'll be here like in a month or two.
Right.
Which is really crazy.
Well, Corey just sent me a link with something I know we're going to want to talk about.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that in just a second.
Oh.
For now, let's take our last break for the Archaeology Show, episode 84. Again, if you want this commercial free, either find us live here on Facebook or YouTube or Twitch at Happy Archaeology Fun Time.
Yeah.
Or join us, arcpodnet.com/members, and check out the early download section where you can hear commercial free versions of all of our episodes before they come out to the rest of the public.
Yeah.
So let's take that quick break and we'll be right back. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. Welcome back to episode 84 of the Archaeology Show, and welcome back to all the people who never left on the live recording. So if you want to catch us live, again, happy Archaeology Fun Time on YouTube and Twitch, and then and Richie's Happy Archaeology Fun Time website.
Yeah.
And then, of course, facebook.com/arcpodnet, ARCHPODNET. So Corey sent me on another messaging service that we use an article about something Richie and I have talked about quite a bit, the Rivian electric truck. And it says that they announced that they had a San Francisco event recently, apparently. This is from Yahoo Finance. It said electric vehicle maker Rivian expected prices lower than previously announced. And they were already pretty good prices. We've been talking about the Rivian for a while.
Ooh, there it is.
And yeah, I don't know what the lower prices were announced. I haven't clicked into this
maybe it's
yet.
The fact that Ford was able to negotiate with their suppliers or something.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Because that's the one thing that would make me hesitant with this truck versus, say, the Tesla truck, is this is an upstart truck manufacturer, and like, what's their support going to be like? You know, I mean, Tesla is also relatively new,
true,
but they quickly established themselves. They've got dealerships all around the nation,
true.
They've got a network of charging capability. They've established in a really quick period of time because of the money that Elon Musk has put into it.
Yeah,
they've established themselves as an auto manufacturer, and I think it's a relatively trusted one. They're all over the place, but these guys are brand new.
True. But then Ford invested in them. It's like, you probably haven't been to too many places in the Bay Area, but Ford has these electric bikes. But unlike some of the ones we had here in Reno, you have to bring them back to the docking station.
Oh, right.
Yeah. You know, and they've got the big Ford logo on the side, and obviously that's a money loser, and yet they're still supporting that.
Right.
It's interesting. Actually, have you seen the rental bikes out by the museum?
Here in Reno?
Yeah.
No, I haven't been down there much.
Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Like, I see him parked outside all the time. That's probably
a little bit of a segue.
Yeah.
But back to the Rivian. I mean, that is the biggest thing I would worry about when you're going to spend $40,000 to $60,000 on a vehicle, no matter what kind it is, no matter who makes it. You want to know about support. You know, what happens, especially with this newer technology, what happens when something factory-related breaks? I mean, obviously, if you need body work, somebody else can do that, but...
Oh,
you know.
More importantly, like a manufacturer, like, I don't know, like you have Soto speakers, right?
Yeah.
Have you heard about the controversy with them?
You mean them not supporting the older speakers?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a worry. I hadn't even actually thought about that because I've got the... So one of my speakers, I don't think it would matter for. I've got the Sonos play bar, and that hooks via optical cord to my TV, right?
Oh.
I think that will always work.
Yeah.
But my Sonos Play 1 will literally plug into nothing.
See?
It has to be used wirelessly.
And that's what makes me worry about some of these advanced electric vehicles. Yeah. Like, they can just, like, say, oh, it's time for you to buy a new vehicle. We're going to send one last firmware update that kind of, like, spikes it.
Yeah. I mean, what the heck? You know?
I'm still driving like my old convertible, which is like, what, from 89?
Yeah.
And Volkswagen can't do anything about it.
They really can't. It's out of their hands. That's the other weird relationship we're starting to have with cars. I think it's leading to a future similar to a lot of science fiction futures where we don't actually own cars. I mean, you might have a car where it's always available. It's always on demand to use whenever you want.
Oh, that's
but you
what
don't
I was
going to
say. I was going to say it's like the Netflix model.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cars on demand, but it's not like Uber or a taxi where you have to call it and have it come to you.
Yeah.
It predicts your movements. They're parked everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's literally right there.
Yeah.
You know, it's just waiting. I would even say early on, we might have a model where while they're trying to break into this market, you could actually maybe even rent out your parking space. So it's just sitting in front of your house.
Well, I was going
to
say that CES, I forget the name of the subsidiary, but GM's electric car subsidiary, they also do, they were demonstrating their first autonomous car. And the thing that's crazy about it, no driver's seat, no steering wheel, no controls.
I saw that.
Yeah.
Yep.
And I was like telling my neighbor, like, you know, in 20 years, people are going to be amazed that people actually drove cars themselves. It's like, you know, like, you know, like, it's so weird. I can't just like go into a car and fall asleep or like, you know, play on the internet or something.
Yeah.
Like, think about it. You know, when was the last time you got an elevator and said, I really wish there was someone here to operate the elevator?
I know. I mean, we just forget how much things have changed. I've done a lot of plane. I've been on, let's see, 2, 4, 6, 8, 9, 11.
Yeah.
12, 13, 14. I've been on 15 separate legs of plane flights in the last month.
Yeah.
A month and a half.
Yeah.
And it's amazing how we just take that for granted. Like, yeah, we get in, we sit down, we're not concerned with who's up front. We know somebody's up there, but we're not concerned with it.
But they're just more, they're more like a passenger now.
Well, yeah. And they truly are. The pilots are. But we sit down and we just, you know, we pull out our laptops, we pull out our iPads and our phones, and we just do stuff. And we're so used to that. Why is that so foreign for most people for cars?
See?
You know, I want to sit in a car and do the exact same thing. And yet, no, we're like, I need to drive my car.
See?
You know? Let's take an example again from aviation.
Yeah?
I'm a pilot.
Yeah?
I love to fly planes. I know lots of pilots. I hang out with them all the time, right? I know lots of people that have planes because I'm in the Civil Air Patrol. But I'll tell you what, these guys don't get in a commercial airplane after flying their own airplane and go, this sucks, I wish I could be flying it. No, that's not entirely true. They would love to fly a 737.
Wait, you mean the one they just grounded?
No, not that one, no. They would love to fly a 737, but or I'm just saying that because that's half of American Airlines' fleet is either a 737 or an A320.
Yeah.
But anyway, they would love to fly that, but the point is, they're not sitting there lamenting the fact that we have an aviation industry because they can't fly their own airplane all over the place. They realize that there's a time and a place, and I think that's how it's going to be with us with cars forever, because cars, look at go-karts. Go-karts are not practical to take on the street, right? They're not. But we can go to a place and drive go-karts and have fun. I think there's going to be car parks later in the world where you can either rent cars and take them out four-wheel driving. Like Moab should be getting on this right now. You know, places out here in Nevada should be getting on this right now where they have huge sections of, say, BLM land where you can just go out there and drive. The novelty of driving. You can go through a driving school, learn how to do it.
Oh, my God. Just like Disneyland.
Cars. And your electric car took you there.
Yeah.
You know, and then left. Left you there.
Yeah.
But it knows when you're going to be done, and it will be waiting for you when you get back.
Yeah. Or you can just, like, ask Alexa.
Right. Exactly. So I don't understand why that's such a foreign concept to people and why we can't get on board with it. But I think the transition is obviously electric vehicles and then fully autonomous electric vehicles or partially autonomous.
True.
You know, where we can tell them in certain areas, you know, probably GPS-based and say, okay, now you can fully take over.
Oh, my God. It makes me think of electric bikes. Like, I forget. I don't know if it's been just announced or if it's actually like people are testing it, but oh God, who is the company? Super 73. You know, if you've ever been on Instagram, you've seen them because they look just like mopeds.
Yeah,
but they're not. They're like electric bicycles. And guess what they just announced?
Yeah,
they're a new electric bike that has a 75 mile range.
Oh
yeah, and front and rear suspension.
Nice.
Yeah, which to me is like, wow, that's like we've literally come from like, you know, homemade bicycles, electric bikes that I used to see going around town to like that.
Question for you, 75 miles sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
My bike theoretically is supposed to have a 40 mile range.
Yeah.
Do you know, because you've done a lot more research than I have into this, is that a standard range or is that above and below?
No, that's like
my
standard.
40.
No, that's standard.
40 standard? Okay. Because I wasn't sure what standard was.
Yeah. Well, that's the nice thing about the Rad Power bikes is the fact that you pretty much use off-the-shelf parts, but they provide American backup.
Yeah.
Whereas if you buy something off Amazon, there's literally only like three electric suppliers of electric motors and batteries and stuff, but most of those companies you buy off Amazon, there's like no one behind them.
Right, right.
You know, it's basically just shipped to you straight from China, and then if something goes wrong,
you're kind of SOL.
Sort of. Yeah. Or alternatively, you just get handy with a soldering iron and just like, you know, go on eBay.
My God, you should see. Let's just go off the rails for a second here about electric bikes. I belong to the Rad Power e-bike owners group or whatever on Facebook.
Yeah.
And I just kind of lurk in that group and watch it. And it's so amazing to me.
Yeah.
The types of posts that are in that group. A lot of people that are either thinking about buying a bike or have bought a bike. And I feel like a lot of the owners of e-bikes,
Yeah.
Have never owned a bike that cost more than $200 or $300 before.
Really?
So they're treating this expensive bicycle. Yeah, because I mean, let's be honest, you know the people that are driving that are riding $4,000 road bikes would never touch an e-bike, right? Because that's like sacrilege to them.
True. And they're also nowhere to be found during this cold time of the year, I notice when I go out biking.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, you get this group, so you get a couple of different types of people. The people who they treat this bike like it's the best possession they've ever owned in their life. Yeah. And it's just this most amazing thing. Which is kind of weird to me. And they also treat it like a motorcycle. I see people talking about their full face helmets that they're wearing. And I'm like, listen, this thing is capped at 20 miles per hour. I can go faster than that on my road bike.
Yeah.
And I'm still just wearing a helmet, like a bike helmet.
Yeah.
So they're treating it like that. And then they're loading it up with all kinds of stuff too. Like you see people with these hard shell saddlebags and, you know, I mean, I understand having a few accessories, don't get me wrong, but it's interesting how they overdo it almost. And they would not do that probably with a regular bike.
Because you're the engine.
Well, yeah, I understand that. But I don't think it has to do with the fact that it's powered. I think they just never owned anything like this before. And it's that sort of motorcycle mentality.
True.
Of how much can I carry?
But that's also negative because that's like a lot of people a lot of cyclists who are against electric bikes, that's what they count as like, you know, one of their main arguments is that this is just a motorcycle or a moped or a scooter.
Sure.
Even though it's not really.
I mean, it doesn't matter if it's called an e-bike. I mean, a motorcycle, people still call them bikes. Like, I'm going to take my bike to the grocery store. They often will mean motorcycle, right?
True. But the thing is, they want them out of, like, the bike lanes. And I'm like, no.
Well, yeah. I mean, I see that. But it, to me, the bike lane is more about speed. And since most of these are capped at 20 by state regulation.
Yeah.
I mean, you're still going slower than half of those really into it, you know, road bikers.
Oh, by the way, this integrates with what you're talking about. But I saw my first long wheelbase cargo Rad Power bike yesterday.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it was coming the opposite.
Rover? Yeah. Oh, the Rad Wagon.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like coming the opposite way of me. I'm like, wow, that thing's moving really quickly.
I've seen one of those in town. It's probably the same one.
Ah.
Yeah, because I can't imagine there's too many.
No.
But there could be. It's not more expensive. It's actually only $100 more than the other bikes.
Really?
Yeah. And it's got a I think it's... Does it have a bigger engine? A bigger motor? Sorry, not engine. I don't remember, but I remember seeing it was $15.99 versus $14.99.
Interesting, because the Super 73 I saw is only $2,300. But when you think about the 75-mile range, that's like really good.
Yeah, well, you could get a rad bike and then spend $400 on an extra battery too.
That too, but then you'd have to carry it.
Well, that's true as well. But then that 75 mile range battery's got to be bigger and heavier.
Well, no, it's like literally, I was looking at the bike and it's just like, it literally just looks like a...
But there's something about it though. It's got to be more battery if you're getting that much more range out of it.
Or alternatively, it just could just be the more powerful engine. Because I forget the watts
but
it is.
Which would also mean more battery. Because if you're burning higher wattage on your engine, you need more power to be able to consume that.
Interesting.
So we should switch to the outro.
Oh, yeah. Hang on.
Yeah.
Oh, so my anyway. God. If we're switching the outro, there is one thing I did want to mention.
Yeah.
I saw it in the news, like, this morning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone down the street bought an apartment building. It's not like a crappy apartment building. It's a really, you know, it's like a, but it's still an apartment building.
Mm-hmm.
And they immediately raised the rents by, I think, I want to say 53 or 54%. And then they've the local newspaper here, for people who aren't familiar with it, the Reno Gazette Journal, was like listed the price. I'm like, my God, that's almost about the same as what you and Rachel were paying at the Montage. And I was thinking, man, like some of the people are coming to town and just like buying these apartments and jacking up the rent, like effectively doubling the rent. It's like they really have no clue about what they're buying or the market.
Because here's the problem though, those apartments aren't empty.
Now,
people are buying them.
Well, I mean, we'll see.
Because,
you know, it's one thing to rent an apartment at the Montage and have like, because you had like what? You had a gym.
Oh, we had all kinds of nice amenities.
Yeah, you had a pool, you had a barbecue area, etc. Yeah. And now they're trying to charge the same amount for basically a regular apartment.
Yeah. Like, that's the only reason I would paid what I did at the Montage, which is a high rise condo building in Reno.
Yeah.
The only reason I did that was for the amenities. I never would have paid. We were paying $1,500 a month. I'm not ashamed to say that.
Yeah.
But it was for a 967 square foot one bedroom apartment.
Yeah,
had washer and dryer. It was on the 12th floor. But like Richie said, I mean, we had a nice full length swimming pool that I could do laps in. Two hot tubs out there. Everything, all that was open 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Or closed at midnight, I think. But either way, late enough. And. You know, storage down below. We had storage on the 4th floor.
See?
And bicycles, separate bicycle storage rooms.
Yeah.
which would have been real tough to get my rad bike up there, to be honest. That thing is not light. Yeah. But to get it up on the wall, that's how they stored.
Oh.
Yeah, with the hook on the wall.
Oh, those things.
Yeah. There were storage. There were places along a railing where you could just attach up to that. But, man. Anyway, it
and
was.
And then you had the doorman?
We had 24-hour door service.
And then didn't they like give you coffee or something in the morning?
Yeah, they always had coffee and muffins in the morning from My Favorite Muffin. Or from, what's that one on California?
Oh, wait. Oh, God.
You know what
I know
I'm
what
talking
you're
about.
Like,
yeah. Yeah, some muffin place. Anyway, it was great. God, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I would grab a cup of coffee and a muffin on my way out the door on the way here.
Yeah, but I mean, who would pay that for like a regular
with
apartment?
No amenities.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not even a manager in sight. It's just like a regular apartment building.
Well, we're doing it now. Now we're paying $17.50 a month with mortgage and HOA.
True.
For nothing. For our townhouse where we get no service, you know, but it's just because we own it and we have a townhouse. Who gives a crap? I'm all about what are you getting for this thing? And I'm not getting the same value I am here as I was at the Montage. I have more space, but that's just more space for my garbage, you know, and
true,
I don't need
more
space.
But you also don't have the danger of someone like kicking you out. Like, you know,
well,
landlord.
We kind of do though, because somebody's going to buy that complex, I think, within the next 5 years and mow it down.
You think so?
Yeah, but you get market value for it anyway. I'll be ready to sell by then.
Yeah.
So, hell, I'll be ready to sell in a year. So, and then I'll move into my 500 square foot boat and be happy with it. So,
interesting.
You know,
it's almost as much room as I got in my apartment. I might be wrong.
Yeah, I was looking at it. Most of your 50 footers are, you know, your bedrooms generally 10 or 12 by 10 or 12 feet for the stateroom. And then the salon is, you know, 20 feet by 10 feet, give or take, whatever the beam is.
Yeah.
And then you add some of the other spaces there, depending on what you count as square footage, probably less than 500 square feet, to be honest. But then do you count all the storage? Do you count the lazarette, which is the storage under the rear cockpit? You know, sometimes there's like a full dropped in, like I saw a boat that had, a lot of times it's called the lazarette. So when you walk onto the aft end of like the boxy end of one of those big motor yachts.
Yeah.
That's called the cockpit, which is weird to me because in airplanes, the cockpit is where you drive.
Yeah.
But in these, the cockpit is in the back. It's called the helm or the the lower or upper helm, you know, where they actually steer. But the cockpit is in the back in the transom area of a boat. But underneath that, there's usually storage compartments. And some boats just have big holes where you can jam stuff like ropes and lines and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But some of them have, like, you open it and you can, like, take these ladder down. And I saw one, I was looking at a YouTube video, one that had like a deep freezer back there, like a chest freezer.
Wow.
And like a whole bunch of storage and stuff like that. I mean, does that count in your square footage?
Ooh.
I would think it might, probably should.
Depends on how to calculate it.
Yeah, I don't know.
Interesting.
But you never see square footage on boats, though. You only see length and beam. Beam is the width.
Yeah. Oh, more importantly, are you going to try to visit some of the more famous like places where people like set up their boat like, you know, for free? And just like, you know, like the... like in the Bay Area, there are certain spots that were famous, you know, for they were basically illegally mooring their boats there.
I have no idea, but I'd love to check it out.
Yeah.
So
it's kind of like the boating equivalent of that place in the Southern California desert where people like Slap City.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, I should probably throw this out there before I forget. I was thinking about it, you know, for people at home, because I already talked with Chris about this.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure we're going to be able to get it set up next week. But basically, since it's the turn of the decade, I mean, technically, the decade ends like this December, not, you know, December of the 10th.
Bullshit. We're in the 20s.
Fine.
The decade ended.
But more importantly, a lot of people were doing retrospectives on like what it's like to use this equipment or that equipment, you know, because like a lot of people think that to get in the podcasting, you need like a lot of like... there are literally people who like have recorded like one podcast or even no podcast. Like, you know, at least one person who's like recorded nothing with all their equipment. They spent like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dollars on equipment.
Yeah.
And yet you don't really need any of that.
No.
And so lately I bought a whole bunch of equipment, mainly to do live streaming at home.
Mm-hmm.
Like these technically, even though they say realistic, they're actually manufactured by Shure for a Radio Shack. And so they're real Shure mics. Yeah.
Wow, it's nice and heavy.
Yeah. And like one of these I paid $15 for, and the other I paid like $25, but it came with the box and all the original stuff on it. Mm. And I forget what Radio Shack asked Shure to model these mics after, but they're modeled after, oh God, an Electro Voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nice.
And and it's like, you know, if you know where to look, you can get equipment for super cheap. And wait, hopefully this doesn't... oh, good. And I got like a recorder. This is like if you were listening to This American Life when they first started, this is what they would have been using. something like this.
Wow.
This is like one of the, or if you were like being interrogated by the police in like the early 2000s.
It's got two XLR inputs on the bottom of it.
Yeah, and they're powered. They're 48. Yeah. You know, in fact, they actually, you know, and it's, I was actually using it. The sound quality about it isn't bad, but I was thinking, mm-hmm. even though it's like digital and even though it probably isn't going to be that much different, I was thinking we're going to, I'm going to challenge Chris to see if we can record a podcast with it and see if it sounds just as good. Because this podcast, this, all this stuff that I've got here costs less than the price of a Zoom H1N, which is like a $100 recorder. That's generally considered an entry-level recorder. So basically, this costs all less than that.
Well, I have no doubt that this would record, the actual audio recording would be okay. It really depends on the options for the type of file. I like to record a WAV file that's 48 kilohertz should, by 24-bit depth.
It should.
Yeah. But the other thing would be, I mean, sure, the digital recording is one thing, but really what makes a recording is the microphone. So how do these sound is the question.
That's what I'm curious about, too.
Because I could plug these into this. We could use them right here.
Yeah.
You know, they're just XLR mics. We don't need to test that thing out if we just want to test the mics out.
Ooh, we could try that, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, so basically we'll see what we can get done next week.
Yeah.
I just wanted to throw out there. That way, you know, we have to do it now.
Yeah, exactly.
We have to do something. We don't necessarily use the whole setup, but we can at least see how the mics sound.
Sure. All right. Well, that's it for this episode.
Yeah.
We may or may not have an episode next week, depending on my schedule and what I'm doing.
Yeah.
But definitely find us on all the things. You're here on Facebook, of course, and you're here on YouTube and Twitch. But if you're on one of those and you don't know about the other one, check out Richie's website, happyarchaeologyfuntime.com.
Yeah. And I'm on Facebook, obviously, Happy Archaeology Fun Time and stuff like that. You know, and that's my name on all the, like, that's actually not my name on all the socials.
It's really not.
No.
Can you say it without screwing it up?
No. Well, I mean, yes, I can. I'd have to spell it out, though.
Yeah.
It's at FTBVANDUPTDS, which if you're a Sam archaeologist, you might recognize that as beer and cigarettes.
There you go.
Yeah. Technically beer and cigarette cans, but whatever.
That's right. All right. Well, thanks, Richie.
Yeah.
And thanks, everybody, for joining us. And we will see you next time on the Archaeology Show and on this live show.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show was produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song, I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks. And in the meantime, keep learning, keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.